or can we say that there hasn't been an intellect or intellectual designer, the intellectual designer
behind this, yes.
Behind all of this?
And that intellectual designer, we call him God.
Exactly. You the unmovable mover. The unmovable mover.
The unseen seen. I don't know, we can
that's
use
nice. That's nice.
Different terminologies yeah. for him. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala...
The intellectual or the intellectual designer.
Yes.
Right?
And if we, for our Muslim brothers and sisters, if we can refer to the first sermon of Imam Ali in Nahj al-Balagha, there Imam is talking about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even the creation as well. So when he's talking about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he says, if you want to imagine him, that is also wrong. Because you can never imagine him. How can a limited thing imagine something which is unlimited? It's beyond your capacity. It's beyond our capacity. And also in the Quran, obviously, we have that Allah has created the heavens and the earth, like the whole universe or galaxy, the whole universe in 7 days and 7 nights. So these are the different phases.
When we say 7 days, it's we do seven, not mean these seven physical yes. days
some
that we have
places,
today.
Six
we mean
stages.
It could be millions of years. It is seven stages,
it's
exactly.
It's basically seven stages or
yeah,
six
exactly.
stages.
It could have been billions of yes. years in between.
For right. example, in the first stage, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created this solar system or galaxy. And he separated like heavens and earth. In the next stage, we can say like Allah has obviously, because he has created that, there are some effects, after everything is on its own place. So within those effects, we can see the creation of the earth and the rest of the, we can say, creations, or maybe raining or water and all those. And it is very much clear, we can, scientifically it is proved that if anything that is alive, it's because of water.
Right.
It has some
right.
sense of water in it. And also Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala clearly says that we made everything alive with water.
Right. And don't forget, dear brothers and sisters, that the most developed astronomers were among the Muslims. The devout Muslim scholars who also were into astronomy. And they belong to whom? You have Khayyam, you have Abu Rayhan Biruni, and so on and so forth. Khawarazm or Khwarazm. You have all these great scientists, and you have craters named by them. You have Tusi. Tusi, the famous Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi. You have craters named by them on the moon by Americans. Can you imagine that? Al-Biruni crater, the Tusi crater, and so on.
So basically, it is about the... It's not about like everything is going on its own. The main point is the people who... Like the person who has asked the question, he could never understand the system of cause and effect, this universe, which is made on cause and effect. Everything has a cause, everything. Sometimes we know the causes, sometimes we do not know. The causes are hidden. For those,
so we do not deny empiric science.
Yes.
We do not deny experimental science.
So basically, that's why I said we accept Big Bang theory not wholly and solely.
Right.
Like when it says there was a Big Bang and after that the things were in the made, like they become... Like the things were in creation, they were created, we accept it.
Yeah.
But when they say like this, it has happened on its own, that's
right.
what we do not accept.
Exactly.
Because, you know, even
because
in
that
today's...
Because that is unreasonable.
Because
that
in today's world...
That is unscientific
world, yes.
to say such a statement.
In today's world even, there are many years that the human beings are living in this on this world, in this on this earth. They haven't seen anything like this. For example, Darwin's theory... How many times have you seen an ape becoming a human being?
Zero.
From since the human like is living on this earth, how many times you have seen?
Zero.
It's a theory.
Mm.
It's a theory,
right.
which is totally wrong. So one of the things that can be, if you say that these are tangible for us, we can see that the hot clouds or the cold clouds, they get together and then there's a rain. So when you can see this, can you show us an example of ape becoming a human? Or can you show us another example of a Big Bang or maybe a small explosion that has happened on its own without any cause being there?
Right, right.
No.
Thank you very much, Sid.
Jazakallah
khairan, and thank you, dear listeners, for joining us in this program of Questions and Answers. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
Round the world with reporters.
The Palestinian leadership has praised the International Criminal Court for its ruling that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories, allowing its chief prosecutor, Fatou Ben Souda, to investigate Israeli atrocities, despite fierce objections from Tel Aviv. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtayi said the decision is a victory for justice, humanity, and freedom, and for the blood of the victims, namely the Palestinians and their families. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also praised the ruling and said it's ready to cooperate with the ICC's prosecutor if an investigation is launched.
We urge the International Court and its chief prosecutor to immediately launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinian people. We have already filed several legal complaints against Israel with the ICC. We are now ready to carry out every possible effort to see Israeli military officials and settlers being prosecuted for their crimes.
The ICC's ruling, however, has angered the Israeli regime, as its Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, dismissed the ruling as a political tribunal, accusing the ICC for being a political body and not a legal institution. Israel has not joined the International Criminal Court, but the Palestinian Authority is a signatory since 2015. This means the ICC's mandate is to prosecute people, not countries, including those from states that are not signatories, and in this case, Israeli leaders, military officials, and soldiers who are accused of carrying out crimes against Palestinians.
I doubt that that will make such a difference in Israel, because if we know the nature of Israel and it's based on violence, based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and grabbing the land of Palestine, because of that, I don't think that will make a big difference for the Israeli policies in the region.
The Palestinians have asked the court to look into Israeli crimes during its 2014 war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as Israel's construction of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The ICC's decision paves the way for the tribunal's prosecutor to open a war crime investigation. But the main question lingering in mind is that will the U.S., which has furiously condemned the court, allow prosecution of Israeli officials and forces over their crimes committed in the Palestinian territories? Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks. The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population. U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
The International Criminal Court has ruled that it has jurisdiction to examine possible Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the court announced that it has decided by majority that its territorial jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The ICC's decision has been praised by Palestinians, with Prime Minister Mohammad Shataye calling it a victory for justice.
The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of crimes that their crimes will not be subject to statutes of limitations and that they will not go unpunished.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also called the ruling a historic day for the principle of accountability, and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the court to investigate the Israeli crimes, describing its decision as a major development. Different international human rights organizations have also reacted, with Amnesty International calling the decision a long overdue step towards justice for victims. Human Rights Watch also described the ruling as a real hope for victims of serious crimes. Israel, which is not even a member of the ICC, decried the ruling, saying the court is a political body, not a judicial institution. As expected, the U.S. officially opposed the court's decision. Experts say the ruling is a game-changer for Tel Aviv and Washington.
Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, President Biden will face an interesting challenge. I expect that his reaction will be considerably different than Trump's.
The ruling came amid Palestine's call for further scrutiny into the 2014 Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, in which more than 2,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, were killed. 6 years ago, the office of the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, began a preliminary investigation of Israeli actions in Gaza. In 2019, Bensouda announced that there was a reasonable basis for opening an investigation into the Gaza war and the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Ironically, Israel has continued its crimes against the Palestinians and its expansionist agenda, including illegal settlement activities with the tacit support of the United States and in defiance of UN resolutions. International rights groups have long raised the alarm about Israeli atrocities. Last year, the UN also said that Tel Aviv's excessive force against Palestinians holding weekly anti-occupation rallies may amount to war crimes. The latest ICC ruling has dealt a severe blow to Israel, but will the Palestinians get the justice for crimes they have endured for decades remains to be open.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured, and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence.
Also, Western media never mentioned the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable, and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only, an energy supplier. It's as well a strategic relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir. With tensions continue to increase, there is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Boazaji University continue protesting the appointment of AKP-affiliated rector. University academics turned their back to the newly appointed rector's office as a symbol of objection. The academics called for the resignation of Melih Bulu, the rector that was appointed by Turkish president. Protests have been going for weeks now, with police arresting hundreds. Demonstrations broke out early January when Turkish president appointed Melih Bulu, an academic with strong ties with the ruling party, as the new rector for Boğaziçi University. Students and academics complained that the appointment broke a decade-long tradition of Boğaziçi rectors being elected from within the university academic team. The Boğaziçi crisis gathered support from other universities and oppositions, who saw in this new trial from the president to force control over the country after granting himself sweeping powers post-coup attempt in 2016. Erdogan said the protests are not led by students, claiming it is stamped by opposition parties.
A segment of politics is leading the way for this. It is not possible to describe and accept the protests as incidents about the university students. Turkey's opposition parties, including main opposition, Republican People's Party, and E-Party, as well as People's Democratic Party, are behind all of this.
Turkish president also slammed the U.S. and France over their reaction to the protest, mentioning the incidents taking place ahead of U.S. elections and calling French President Macron to take care of the Yellow Vest protest in his country before pointing fingers to what is happening in Turkey. Erdogan argued that the law grants the president the authority to appoint rectors and that he had done it before in other universities.
The whole issue broke out after the president appointed the new rector. This is not against the law, but the problem is that Melih Blu isn't an academic and this is against the law. I disagree that the protests were driven by political parties. It started by students. Of course, opposition parties are taking advantage of the protests to lash out at the president.
The government response to the protest came harsh, as peaceful protests have been met with overwhelming violence and arrests. Critics and human rights activists say those are efforts by Erdogan to seize more power using the coup plot as a scarecrow. The Boğaziçi protest brings to mind the huge Gezi Park protest held years ago, with many saying that it will continue because the problem is in the system itself. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S.-guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the one-China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been in loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind. ¶¶
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions call for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus, also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government. But that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profit without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many.
It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
The limelight.
When House impeachment managers prosecute former President Donald J. Trump this week for inciting the Capitol attack, they plan to mount a fast-paced cinematic case aimed at rekindling the outrage lawmakers experienced on Wednesday, 6th of January. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalist Nicholas Flandos. The piece is titled Impeachment Case Aims to Marshal Outrage of Capital Attack Against Trump. Stay with us for more of Nicholas Flandos' article. Impeachment managers prosecute former President Donald J. Trump this week for inciting the Capitol attack. They plan to mount a fast-paced cinematic case aimed at rekindling the outrage lawmakers experienced on Wednesday, 6th of January. Armed with lessons from Mr. Trump's first impeachment trial, which even Democrats complained was repetitive and sometimes sanctimonious, the prosecutors managing his second are prepared to conclude in as little as a week, forgo distracting witness fights, and rely heavily on video, according to six people working on the case. It would take 17 Republicans joining every Democrat to find Donald Trump guilty, making conviction rather unlikely. But when the trial opens on Tuesday at the very scene of the invasion, the prosecutors will try to force senators who lived through the deadly rampage as they met to formalize President Biden's election victory to reckon with the totality of Mr. Trump's months-long drive to overturn the election results and his failure to call off the assault on the Capitol. The story of the president's actions is both riveting and horrifying, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, and the lead prosecutor said in an interview. Jamie Raskin added, "We think that every American should be aware of what happened, that the reason he was impeached by the House and the reason he should be convicted and disqualified from holding future federal office is to make sure that such an attack on our democracy and on our Constitution never happens again." Making Mr. Trump the first American president to be impeached twice, Democrats have essentially given themselves an unprecedented do-over. When Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, was preparing to prosecute Mr. Trump the first time for a pressure campaign on Ukraine, he read the 605-page record of President Bill Clinton's 1999 impeachment trial cover to cover, sending aides as many as 20 dispatches a day as he sought to modernize a proceeding that had happened only twice before. This time, a new group of nine Democratic managers need reach back only a year to study the lessons of Mr. Schiff's prosecution. Don't antagonize Republicans, use lots and lots of video, and above all, make succinct arguments to avoid lulling the jury of lawmakers into boredom or distraction. Donald Trump's lawyers have indicated that they once again intend to mount a largely technical defense, contending that the Senate lacks jurisdiction to judge a former president at all after he has left office, because the Constitution does not explicitly say that it can. Though many legal scholars and a majority of the Senate disagree, Republicans have flocked to the argument in droves as a justification for dismissing the case without weighing in on Donald Trump's conduct. But the lawyers, Bruce Castor and David Schoen, also plan to deny that Mr. Trump incited the violence at all or intended to interfere with the Congress's formalizing of Joe Biden's victory, asserting that his baseless claims that the election was stolen are protected by the First Amendment. And Bruce Castor told Fox News that he, too, would rely on video, possibly of unrest in American cities led by Democrats. The managers will try to rebut them as much with constitutional arguments as an overwhelming compendium of evidence. J. Jeremy Raskin's team has spent dozens of hours culling a deep trove of videos captured by the mob, Mr. Trump's own unvarnished words, and criminal pleas from rioters who said they acted at the former president's behest. The primary source material may replace live testimony. Trying to call new witnesses has been the subject of an extended debate by the impeachment managers, whose evidentiary record has several holes that White House or military officials could conceivably fill. At the last trial, Democrats made an unsuccessful push for witnesses, a centerpiece of their case. But this time, many in the party say they are unnecessary to prove the charge and would simply cost Mr. Biden precious time to move his agenda without changing the outcome of the trial. It's not that there should not be witnesses, it's just that the practical realities of where we are with a former president, said Daniel S. Goldman, a former House lawyer who worked on Mr. Trump's first impeachment. This is also something that we learned from the last trial. This is a political animal, and these witnesses are not going to move the needle. Jeremy Raskin and other House managers declined to speak about strategy, but current and former officials familiar with the confidential preparations agreed to discuss them anonymously. The prosecutor's almost complete silence in the run-up to the trial has been another departure from the strategy of Mr. Trump's first impeachment, when Democrats set up a sizable communications war room in the Capitol and saturated the cable television airways in an all-out battle against Mr. Trump in the court of public opinion. They have largely left it to trusted allies like Adam Schiff and Speaker Nancy Pelosi to publicly discuss their case and bat back criticism about why the House is pressing its case even now that Mr. Trump is out of office. If we were not to follow up on this, we might as well remove any penalty from the Constitution of impeachment. Just take it out, Nancy Pelosi told reporters who questioned why Democrats would consume so much of Congress's time with a former president. Key questions about scope and shape of the trial remain unsettled. Senators spent the weekend haggling over the precise structure and rules of the proceedings, the first time in American history a former president will be put on trial. Prosecutors and Mr. Trump's defense lawyers expected to have at least 12 hours each to make their case. Jeremy Raskin, a former constitutional law professor, has been coaching his colleagues in daily meetings to aggressively winnow down their arguments, cling to narrative where possible, and integrate them with visual aids they plan to display on television screens in the Senate chamber and on screens across the country. Behind the scenes, Democrats are relying on many of the same lawyers and aides who helped assemble the 2020 case, including Suzanne Shazman-Grooms from the House Oversight and Reform Committee, and Aaron Hiller, Arya Hariharan, Sarah Istel, and Amy Rutkin from the Judiciary Committee. The House also temporarily called back Barry H. Burke, a seasoned New York defense lawyer, to serve as chief counsel, and Joshua Matz, a constitutional expert. Adam Schiff said his team had tried to produce an HBO miniseries featuring clips of witness testimony to bring to life the esoteric plot about Mr. Trump's pressure campaign on Ukraine. Mr. Raskin's may appear more like a blockbuster action film. The more you document all the tragic events leading up to that day, and the president's misconduct on that day, and the president's reaction while people were being attacked that day, the more and more difficult you make it for any senator to hide behind those false constitutional fig leaves, said Adam Schiff, who has informally advised the House managers. To assemble the presentation, Jeremy Raskin's team has turned to the same outside firm that helped put together Mr. Schiff's multimedia display. But Mr. Raskin is working with vastly richer material to tell a month-long story of how he and his colleagues believed that Donald Trump seeded, gathered, and provoked a mob to try to overturn his election defeat. There are clips and tweets of Donald Trump from last summer warning he would only lose if the election was rigged against him. Clips and tweets of him claiming victory after his election loss, and clips and tweets of state officials coming to the White House as he sought to stop the steal. There is audio of a call in which Donald Trump pressured Georgia's Secretary of State to find the votes needed to reverse Mr. Biden's victory in Georgia, as well as presidential tweets and accounts by sympathetic lawmakers who say that once those efforts failed, Mr. Trump decisively turned his attention to the January 6th meeting of Congress for one last stand. At the center is footage of Donald Trump speaking outside the White House just hours before the mob overtook the police and invaded the Capitol building. The House manager's pre-trial brief suggests they are planning to juxtapose footage of Mr. Trump urging his supporters to fight like hell and march to the Capitol and confront Congress with videos posted from members of the crowd who can be heard processing his words in real time. Even with this trial, where senators themselves were witnesses, it's very important to tell the whole story, Adam Schiff said. This is not about a single day, it's about a course of conduct by a president to use his office to interfere with a peaceful transfer of power. But the proximity could also create complications. Several people familiar with the preparation said the House managers were wary of saying anything that might implicate Republican lawmakers who echoed or entertained the president's baseless claims of election fraud. To have any chance of making an effective case, the House managers believe they must make it clear that it is Donald Trump who is on trial, not his Republican Party.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. We want to talk about Iran's developments since 1979 in different fields and on different aspects. Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, since the occurrence of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, 1979, about 42 years have passed, and in these, we can say 42 years, different achievements and developments were made by the Islamic Republic of Iran. You know, today we want to talk a little bit crystal clear about such developments since 1979 in Iran, and let's get first to one of the most important things which has been among the main slogans and the mottos of the late Imam Khomeini, and that is establishing social justice. You can see that in the slogans of Imam Khomeini, he said that the government I'm going to establish is for poverty, or the barefooted people.
Yeah.
It means those first class of the society, I mean the poorest, we can say, class of the society you are talking about.
Yeah.
At the same time,
I wanted to bring some more actually evidences and witnesses from the time of Shah.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, without having this biased look at the history, if he goes back and see the history at the time of Shah, we'll see clearly and vividly that there was there were only two classes of the society, low and aristocrats. And so low levels and high levels. There was no, actually, I don't want to say that there was no middle class, but the number was too little, that there was too few that could not be looked at. Some say that the income per capita is also another criteria for distinguishing that if this society is going towards social justice or not. I want to also deny and nullify this theory as well, because even in some societies that income per capita is too much, we see the homeless people, like for example European and American countries. Mm-hmm. We see that how many homeless as they refer to, and the income per capita is too much, but the number of people nomadics are too much. So it doesn't mean that even income per capita is another a good also criteria for distinguishing or for reaching to this conclusion that if this society is moving towards social justice or not. But some other factors, some other issues, like for example infrastructure or distribution of water, electricity, gas, and also hygiene, can be looked at good criteria to decide if this society is moving towards social justice. I want just you, and respected brothers who are in the studio, just judge yourself. Did people who were benefited from, for example, education or hygiene at the same level that they are benefited today in Islamic Republic?
You know, brother, some people, in order to answer your criticism, some other people say that if another government or another regime instead of Islamic
but
Republic
we have experienced
have
many
place,
many kinds of regimes
there were the natural developments that were made after in 42 years we could see that
even if it was the Shah that much development could be achieved as well, right? This is what it can
or any other government, that's right,
and or any other government.
Yes,
okay, but we have experienced it, brother. Look in at the 35 years of two Shahs. We have seen Kings. How much we have been progressing. So, but we see in the 40 years of this revolution, year by year, the numbers and the statistics and the indexes and coefficients that are looked at as official numbers that also are actually flying. So, if we want to make a comparison, okay, what even if in comparison to the governments of other countries,
that's right.
Even check the rate of this progress. Does it go right, for example, ordinarily? Mm-hmm. Because the range of production of science or knowledge in Iran is 11 times more than the normal average of the world. So, so isn't it a good, let's say, index to make our judgments a little bit
It is a good statistics you are talking about. But
I think we should, for those who say, even if there was another government, they could also achieve, or maybe the Shah's or Pahlavi's regime, they could achieve throughout this time, mm-hmm. these 40 years. So the question is then, is this current regime that is mm-hmm. running the country or the system, if this is doing good, then it is fine. It has achieved the social justice.
Socio-economic, political justice, okay.
It has achieved. Mm-hmm. So there is no problem with the current regime then. There is mm-hmm. no problem with the current system.
Okay.
If they say, like, if there was anyone else, he could also achieve this, mm-hmm. it means that this system is going on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously traveling towards the social justice, social, economical, and political justice.
But the question, Sayyid, is...
That's the main criteria to judge a government,
I know, but in contradiction to the other systems of governing a society, Islamic Republic of Iran and Islamic Revolution of Iran had some slogans and mottos, okay, which are going to be achieved. As you say, the social justice, the economic, political justice we are talking about, and Iran is a very rich land. Now, the question is, in comparison with those slogans, because when you are talking about the capital system, then the monetary and financial boosting and we can say developments is something natural. But when you're talking about in an Islamic system of thought, which was, we can say, very much developed by the late Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution of Iran, then the criteria are different. I mean, based on those criteria, and how do you find Iran now?
Well, I find very well.
Very well. The best.
Why? You know, the reason is, the reason is, when we talk about the system that is following a capitalism, for example, is following a capital system, it means that he is under the orders of America.
Okay.
That's straightforward. For example, like at the time of the the Pahlavi, Iran has donated so many dollars to different places. Whenever America had issue with Somalia, with Morocco, I don't know, with other places, Iran has sent its soldiers, and it has, it's obviously the losses as well. It has bear the losses as well.
That's right.
That's under that system.
Okay.
Now, the problem is when you're against the system, and even after that, you're basically achieving so many things in the sciences, in the social the system, in the politics, in the economics.
Yeah.
If you're achieving all these things with all those sanctions, it means that you have the best system right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have sanctions, because you have you're bounded to some limits, because you're not following that so-called system that is in the world.
Yes.
Even after that, if you have reached to this point, it means that this system is better than those systems. And those systems are not allowing you to freely basically go and achieve the things that you have, the slogans that you
have. That's right.
So basically it shows me that this system, with all these sanctions, with all these limitations that it has, it has done a good job.
Moreover, in order to complete Said's actual explanation, I want to ask the brothers or sisters who are listening to us, and the respected brothers who are here in the studio, to tell me if I'm thinking right or wrong. I think in our today's Iran, we are facing with a large middle class where actually there are some characteristics for. One is that relative welfare can be seen. Relative welfare. I'm not talking about, welfare in a specific sense.
Okay.
Education. I think that distribution of education looks quite normal, because in comparison to before a revolution, when we had 154,000 students all. For example, in one of our provinces, in Kogli Bui Rahmat, we had only 17 people educated more than diploma.
Okay.
So if you want to say with what kind of progress we can reach to this status now that we have today, that we have more than 4 million educated students or graduated students, at least from in the BA level.
That's right.
So this comparison, even in the most developed countries, actually can be at least interpreted in some good way.
That's right.
And urbanization also for this middle class can be seen still. Growth of political and social awareness, and then social authority, and in most important point, security that the people are actually facing today. I think these are easy elements to be asked, not from our dads, from our grandfathers.
The main reason must not be forgotten. And this is what we forget nowadays, unfortunately, also in the system and also the people of Iran. And that was the revolutionary spirit that existed on different organizations in order to organize Iran after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. We could see that we had, for example, Jahad-e Kishavarzi, the agricultural jihad organization, Jahad-e Sazandegi, which was, you know, so establishment jihad. We had Nehzade Savadamuzi, the literacy movement in Iran. And all these organizations led by revolutionary people had their role and had their spirit distributed among all parts of the country and the society. Now, the question is this. A system like Islamic Revolution of Iran, led by these systems, is absolutely successful and can be a role model all around the world. But if we are going to stop over there and do not produce any more system like that, then the ideal system wished by the late Imam Khomeini and also the Rahbar now would not be achieved, brother.
Very true.
I think
because now we could see that in leading a society and in ruling a society nowadays, we could see the signs and the footsteps of capitalism in our society, brother.
Yeah.
This is not at all Islamic. The banking system, the interest rate, stock markets, The name is Islamic, but look, the system is not other.
When we are talking about actually these indexes that we have been talking from the early minutes of this show, actually we did not want to ignore all the problems and deficiencies that we have. No one can ignore all, for example, pressures that are coming and imposed from outside towards Iran, or even the mistakes that we have. No, these are not just to justify everything. We actually made a comparison in some aspects, in some actually levels with our previous regime. So it does not mean that our banking system needs to be modified and corrected, and it has lots of problems. Mm-hmm. It does not mean that, for example, there is no poverty, as I said, at all. But the general movement of this society towards the social justice looks sane.
And looks good.
Looks good.
I think there is the best thing about this revolution, that even the Supreme Leader has said, I'm a revolutionary.
Yes.
These things, the things that you have said, yes, like the systems that were developed in this country was from the revolution.
Yeah.
And the good thing about this revolution is that it's going on. It has not stopped. It has not said that we have achieved everything.
Yes.
The difference between this revolution and the rest of revolutions that happened in the world was that the rest, whenever they had their, like, they got the governments or the power, they were in the power, they said, we achieved our goal. But this revolution is still saying we haven't reached to our goal.
Okay.
We need to go forward, and that's the best thing. And that's why it's creating many more systems within it to make things perfect.
That's right, and that spirit must be kept, you know, and the new generation must understand this, especially in Iran. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Ali Alavian, for your nice elaboration regarding the social, of course, it was socioeconomic justice in Iran after the 1979. We say we are not still talking about a very ideal land. We are elaborating on a comparison made between the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the regime before that, before 1979, and the developments that Iran made after 1979. Thank you much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Do not forget to visit our website at parstraight.com/EN, Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. كان وقام الإمام قام الإمام قام الإمام وقامت برايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام قام الإمام جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام وقامت أسودا تلبي الخمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.